little child. Well, good morning, everybody. And while James sorts out the slides, I say welcome to this session. And actually, just reflect back to the last stakeholder meeting that took place. I think it was July last year. And at that time, it was Claire McNabb who was standing up to talk about the work of the trans work stream. And I think we were all rather stymied at that time, because everything we talked about for 14 or 15 years as trans campaigners tended inevitably to be fairly anecdotal. We had enormous amounts of mail coming in telling us from trans people the sort of problems they were having with their health, but we weren't able to actually really give it a measure and actually say that there were some firm figures around that. Well, over the last 12 months, a lot has happened. We were very fortunate to get some funding from the Equalities Review and the Cabinet Office to carry out what turned out to be the largest survey of its kind anywhere in the world on the wider trans population by my colleague Stephen Whittle and a couple of other professional researchers. And the figures that they produced, and which have been published alongside the main Equalities Review report, actually shocked us, and I'm sure that they will perhaps shock you as well. What the figures showed in terms of health is that this isn't a little bit of a problem, it's a goddamn awful problem. It's a big one, it's almost total. For 80% of trans people to be saying that the NHS has failed them in some way isn't a small accident, it's not a blip, it's a major issue. And perhaps it is simply indicative of a wider problem within the NHS in terms of prejudices that run deep and ways of thinking that run deep. And I think actually in seeking to solve some of these issues, we will actually be solving them for a much wider population than the 5,000 or so transsexual people and then transgendered people in the UK. Gender reassignment treatment is available on the NHS. That's the law. Since 1999, a case that went to the Court of Appeal in the case of AD&G versus what was then North West Lancashire Health Authority held that it was unlawful to operate processes which discriminated against, which effectively amounted to an unlawful, a blanket ban on treatment. And that's treatment in the wider sense, not simply gender reassignment surgeries, which is what people think it's all about, but treatment in terms of assessment, and actually treatment in the wider sense that if you're a trans person and you've had your surgery and you've gone on and settled down and got on with your life, the other treatments you want because you've got a bad knee or whatever, that those should be available to you as well on the same basis as everybody else who pays for the health service in this country. So let's look at the numbers, because they bear talking about. Out of those 870 trans people who were surveyed, 6.3% of them said they'd been refused medical treatment. Not simply had bad medical treatment, but actually been refused point blank. And this weekend, I got an email from a trans woman who actually told me she was looking for a journalist she could trust to tell her story to, because she had gone around all the GPs in her area and she'd been mysteriously knocked off the list of every single one of them. She isn't capable of actually seeing a GP anywhere near where she lives because of the way in which she's been treated, because she's a trans woman. But even if people aren't actually being discriminated against to that extent, overall 19.5% of the 870 people surveyed said that they thought their treatment was adversely affected by the fact that the people treating them knew that they had a trans background. That's one in five. So if there are 5,000 trans people, transsexual people in the UK, that's 1,000 people not getting the service that they are actually entitled to by law, because our NHS is supposed to be free at the point of need for everybody. No ifs and buts about it for everybody, and that includes my population as well. 60% on top of that 20%, another 60%, said that their GP or other doctors would like to help, but they lacked the knowledge in order to do so effectively. So these people are actually not anti-trans people. They just haven't had the training in order to be able to provide basic care. Fortunately, that does mean that one in five, 20%, think they're actually getting quite a good deal from their GP, but that's a tiny minority in effect. And this is a significant population that is around to stay. The figures I've had from the gender recognition panel at the beginning of this month show that after 2 years of operation, just over 2,100 people had actually applied for legal recognition of their gender. And we know from following the figures month on month that 98% of those applications are successful. So these people have to be saying that they intend to live as their proper gender for the rest of their lives. They've had to have gone through an evaluation procedure. These are people with a real condition who deserve to be treated as well as everybody else. So where's it failing? Well, it's actually failing in multiple ways, and that's why last year I wrote an article entitled Not So Much a Care Path, More a Steeplechase, because that's what it seems to be. Because at every turn, trans people find that they have barriers in their paths. The first barrier they might encounter is those 6.5% of GPs who just refuse to have anything to do with them whatsoever. The next barrier may be if they've got a sympathetic GP who actually wants to get them evaluated, just to find out what their gender issues are. Not to wheel them off to surgery, because that's everybody's obsession that it's all about surgeries. Just to actually help this individual deal with the very real emotional pressures that they're under and help them actually live a whole and complete life in well-being. We know that there are specific parts of the country where people really are effectively being subjected to what amounts to that unlawful bar on that referral for treatment. Now, Wales is unfortunately outside the scope of SOGIAD because it's across the border, but there have been very particular problems. We know also from correspondence that the Calderdale PCT up around Halifax in West Yorkshire also has particular problems with people waiting an average of 2.5 years for their very first appointment with a gender identity clinic. These are people who, if their issues are not addressed, going back to that previous survey by Stephen Whittle, 34.5% of people said that they had considered or attempted suicide or self-harm once or more times prior to receiving treatment. I do want to stress that's not people who've had treatment and then regretted it and feel suicidal. That's actually a very, very small number of people indeed. It's an urban myth that trans people regret their surgeries. And you can see it's an urban myth from the statistics that I gave you before from the gender recognition panel. Because people who are regretting the treatment they've had don't go through all the hoops and pay the bill to have legal recognition of their gender. There is sign of actually improvement within Calderdale, but I just want to actually give you some very recent figures. They're so recent, they actually arrived with me this morning while I was getting ready to come here. Calderdale has a population of about 192,000 people. And within that population, this isn't necessarily exactly representative of all PCTs, but I want to give you an idea of scale. The PCT has now revealed that each year they spend £21,000 of a £250,000 budget for the entire region on five gender dysphoric patients. So this is not huge sums of money. I've calculated that if you were to treat all trans people promptly through the NHS the way we say they should be treated, then the maximum it would cost the NHS is around about £2 million a year. That's in an organisation that spends getting on for £50 billion a year. So trans people are around about 1 in 11,500 of the population. But in fact, all we're costing the NHS to treat us for that condition is about 1/25,000th of the NHS budget. So actually being nice to trans people isn't going to cripple the NHS. Is not even going to approximate to taking our fair share of that budget numerically. It's simply going to be doing a good job. And to not do the job, as I keep stressing, is unlawful. So we've got to actually work out how to solve that. Just going back to where it's failing, as I say, we've mentioned GPs, but there's also talked about excessive waiting times. One of the problems that actually gives rise to all this is an almost total absence of choice. Again, figures I received this morning indicate that there's probably only a couple of PCTs in the entire country who actually offer patients the opportunity to choose where they go for their treatment. And because of that, and actually the majority of them are then referred to one centre in London, which probably because of its volumes gets a lot of stick. I don't want to completely blacken its name because there are some people doing some good work there as well, but it could improve significantly, and that's what we want to help them to do through some of the work we're doing through SOGIAG. So actually I've covered some of these figures already. The NHS carries out 100 gender reassignments per year. That's a figure we've actually had from the Minister in Parliament. And we know from the other statistics we've got by deduction there are about another 100 people who go abroad for their treatment. And actually, by and large, seem to get better value for money. They actually get better treatment for less money. So if you can afford it, then you just give the NHS a wide berth. The unfortunate problem is we're finding that when people have done that and then come back to Britain, they're actually finding that some of their PCTs are actually refusing to then do any remedial treatment or any follow-up treatment on any part of their body that's been operated on in that way. But I do want to stress, because unfortunately whenever we talk about this, we tend to focus upon gender reassignment, that's not the be-all and end-all. No matter how long it takes, probably the gender reassignment episode in a trans person's life, we hope, takes only about 2 or 3 years out of a lifetime that's probably going to be 70 or 80 years. So it's a very small part. And actually, the rest of the time, we need to ensure that trans people are treated well by the NHS. So we don't have the situation that arose last year when a colleague of mine needed to be referred for some surgery on a problem with her knee, and the introductory letter to the specialist who was going to deal with her knee spent 3 paragraphs discussing her transsexual history, and 1 paragraph just happening to mention on the side that she'd got a knee complaint. So, as well as lifelong care, making sure that people live long and healthy lives, because that actually costs society a lot less than letting them get ill. We also, the NHS is one of the country's biggest employers, if not the biggest. And a lot of people want to work in health and social care at all levels. One of the surgeons who operated on the Queen Mother's hip was a trans woman. You know, it's not just people at nursing level or working in care homes as care workers. Throughout the NHS, we want it to be good at being able to retain existing staff who transition on the job, as many commercial organisations are now getting better at doing, and also being able to recruit its fair share of very talented and caring people who just happen to have a trans background. So let's talk about the trans work stream now, because that's what you've actually come to hear about. This time last year, the work stream hadn't managed to have a meeting, so one of our first challenges was to actually do that, and we finally managed to get round everybody's holidays by September and actually sit down, and then I really worked them hard. There are about 15 people on the group, and what we've tried to do is to balance that between a small representation of trans people, a representation of people with a medical and commissioning background who can keep us well advised from point of view of what's feasible and how things work in the NHS, and also some representatives from other government departments who are likewise interested in the equality impacts of healthcare working well. After that mega session in September, which really was an exhausting day, we actually came out with a working plan for how we were going to set about 4 key projects, 2 of them research-based and 2 of them educationally-based, to try and take us forward and actually start to put us on the right track. So the research projects we kicked off were 2. One, which is actually hopefully going to get underway very shortly, which is effectively an outcomes audit on patients who've actually been through gender identity clinics in the UK. Originally, it was conceived to be a London-centric idea, but we realise that that isn't really practical, because with so many people actually being referred to London from around the country, people are, you know, coming 250 miles to get their treatment. That's madness. You can't easily distinguish. You'd only have a very small sample of the people actually from the catchment in London itself using the service. And also it would feel a bit unfair on one service to focus all the attention on looking at its outcomes when there are other gender identity clinics and services in the UK as well. So we've got an opportunity here to actually widen the net and have a very, very good look at actually what people are saying about their experiences of actually having been through the system. We're also getting underway a mapping study, again under Stephen Whittle and his team from Manchester Metropolitan University. And they're actually going to be looking in depth at what services are available, how they're set up, what their different policies and standards are, just so that we've got an idea of what the lie of the land is, so we can actually see what there is outside of London and the Charing Cross service, and actually compare how they work and whether, you know, what areas of good practice we might find from within that. And just to give you an example, I saw some figures this morning that suggested that if you're referring people to Leeds Gender Identity Clinic, that could be costing up to £10,000 per patient for the psychiatric referral work and care by the time somebody gets referred to surgery. But if you just go down the road to Sheffield, it may only be costing you £4,500. Now, we've got to understand what the differences are there, what gives rise to that. And there's an important lesson, I think, that needs to be carried out to PCTs, that this isn't just about political correctness. This isn't about just caving into the latest minority who comes along and demands some attention. But actually, when you come to look at this neglected area, which has been neglected for, 50 years, and treated like a backstreet form of healthcare, that there may be some very bad practices which don't represent public value for money. And so we can actually achieve two successes in one. We can actually make things better for trans people, and at the same time, we can save a hell of a lot of money. So we could end up finding that we treat those 200 trans people who actually deserve to be treated on the NHS for the cost that we're currently expending on the 100 who are getting treated on the NHS. And I think that would be a good result if we can actually manage that. I'm always hesitant to point the finger and say bigot or claim prejudice against people. I tend to think that people tend to be more malign. Unfortunately incompetent, I think, would probably be the politest way of putting it. They don't know. People know very little about trans people. I mean, after all, unless you've actually met a trans person, and you know you've met a trans person, then probably all you know about us is what you've read in the tabloid newspapers. And, you know, they're not very reliable, unfortunately. I can't think why. So a lot of the focus of, even before I came on board to chair the work stream, has been about doing the preparatory work to educate people. Last year, with some money from SOGIAG, an excellent DVD was made by a member of our own community, and that's been developed this year by professional trainers to actually produce material around that. I think Graham Rushbrook is actually here this morning. I've lost him now. Are you there, Graham? Would you like to tell us a little bit about that work? See, we're prepared. He's got a microphone as well.
Thanks, Christine. Very briefly, the SOGIAG group commissioned us to undertake a basic awareness training programme, which is to develop a tool for people to use in NHS trusts and social care establishments. I'll say now, the funding was a great help. It probably paid for about the first 4 days of the 25 days work that we've done so far. So just to reinforce what Christine said, this work is no cheaper just because it's about a minority group. It's actually probably more expensive, but committed as we are to making that work happen, we've taken it on and we've continued with it. We developed the training programme with a UK-wide trans working group. And one of the things that was really important, I think, for that piece of work was that we were really explicit with the trans people that contributed to that, either in person or by email, that they were not our commissioners. And there was something that I think we learnt really quickly about being clear with people about what you're inviting them to do and what you're not inviting them to do. So I think for the trans people that were involved at that early stage, the feedback we got was that they felt things were being done with them rather than about them and to them. And I think that's really, really important. We funded their travel and accommodation so that they could be part of that. And as I said, the clarity was really important. They weren't commissioners. They were advisors, and I think that gave them permission to step outside of some of their anxiety about the programme and really engage with it. We delivered the first pilot of the programme 2 weeks ago, and to say it was interesting would be an understatement. We delivered the programme to 18 people. We had a professional external trainer as a participant observer, and they actually fed back about the training, the context of the training itself rather than the material. And the participants fed back on the material. What was quite worrying was the salacious nature of some of the material they wanted to be in the course that we had taken out. So people had fed back that they wanted medical photos, that they wanted medical terminology. And I think it was a shock, although it's reminiscent of some of the stuff that happened around HIV, and it's not a surprise when people's preoccupation appears to be around sexual health. But what was fascinating was that these were, in the main, not basic entry grade level staff. They were commissioners. They were people that were responsible for the delivery of services to a whole section of people, not just trans people. So that's highlighted another training need for inclusive practice for commissioners. And I think that's the strongest message that came out of that programme. They need training around all aspects of inequality. Trans just highlighted their lack of knowledge and lack of skills. And I think your unfortunately incompetent phrase is really kind. I think there are some really dangerous people out there that we're letting loose with money, actually, and they're doing a bad job. So I think we need to capture that with SOGAG over the next year or two. Some of the positives that came out of it, the feedback was that the course worked well. The feedback was that the course was in part too basic, but that's probably to be expected with some of the people that were there. But also that the course was perhaps too complicated for some people because the content was new. The content was something they'd never dealt with.
Okay, thanks very much, Graham. That's
can
very
I just
helpful.
Say one? Oh, yeah, just on. One, thing. One of the things that's really important about it is that it was tested in London, but we've arranged that we're going to test it with a group of generic staff out of London. And one of the feedbacks that we got from the pilot was that it was important for people that weren't in London to have had an opportunity to contribute, and I think that was a real success.
Okay, just because I'm otherwise in danger of overrunning, I'm sure. A couple of these products actually could be probably described with the other work streams as well. We've contributed towards what we, as an internal working title, referred to as the Top 10 Tips Guide for all NHS workers. One side being top 10 things you really ought to know about gay, lesbian, lesbian, gay and bisexual people, and the other side, 10 things you always wanted to know but were afraid to ask about trans people. Another opportunity we had was that the, I think it was the Reducing Health Inequalities workstream, had made a valuable contribution towards an overall project within the NHS to produce a guide for people who'd experienced recent traumatic death. I think it's called Help Is at Hand. They contributed some very valuable information that could be included in the guide about lesbian and gay and bisexual people's needs. But it really was, we recognised, too complicated within the scope of that guide to really do justice to the bereavement issues that surround trans people, whether it's the trans person who's died or whether the trans person is a relative of somebody who has died in that way. So we were able to separately persuade our colleagues on one of the other work streams to fund a little extra work to write a dedicated guide covering that subject, and that's being published now as well. So that was another useful win. Another project I think I'm feeling rather proud of, even though I actually didn't have very much to do with it, is a project carried out by the Sidentity project, which got together a group of young trans people to write for themselves a guide for other young trans people. we're very keen that this should be a hands-off approach with Jay Stewart and his team helping to facilitate the young people to express things in their own way, because I can remember back far enough, and then I'm in my 50s now, but I can remember being young, and you don't want adults telling you how you should think and what you should say about something. So we wanted to capture their feelings about their experiences. And young trans people's experiences are very different these days, because we're seeing the very first generation to have grown up within a society that is more tolerant, where all the information is available. They're actually approaching adulthood with the knowledge that being having a trans background need not be a problem. It need not be something to be ashamed of. It's something that you can actually celebrate and look upon as a positive aspect of your life, and that other people will like and love too. So I think it's very valuable that we've been able to do that. And that has actually just been printed yesterday by the Central Office of Information. Justin is brandishing a copy here. We've managed to get some today. And so we've actually got some tangible results from the last 12 months' work. And finally, so last not least, we've also commissioned the Gender Identity Research and Education Society, GIRES, to produce some more literature for primary care professionals and also for trans people alike, to advise them of their rights, to give them information about how to take hormones safely and so on. All this sort of basic information, which, because it has not existed before, you can't really blame people for not knowing what to do. You can't blame those 60% of trans people's GPs who say, I'd like to help, but I don't know how. Well, we're trying to plug that gap. There are a number of other things that we need to do in order to do that. I think we have to recognise the type of information that we need to impart, because it happens at various levels. Tomorrow, for instance, I'm speaking to representatives of the Ambulance Service Association, and I want to take up with them, for instance, the question of how do you catheterise a trans woman or a trans man? Because there are many professionals out there who are actually a bit frightened of that question, don't know what to do, and I'd rather like to know that, you know, if I ever need it, that they actually have figured it out by the time I get round to that. So what are our plans for the coming year? And this is my last slide now. Well, we've already scheduled to meet again in May. We tend to meet little but do a lot when we do, and in between we work a lot online using email, and that seems to have worked very well with us, getting these existing projects underway. Our first priority is going to have to be to make sure that all these projects that we've commissioned so far, and I'm sure this will be a priority for the other work streams as well, are effectively implemented. It's one thing to spend the money, it's one thing to get the research and to produce the literature, but actually if it's not being out there in the right hands and being used effectively, then we're not achieving the goals that we want to achieve. We want to have a look at the research results when they come in, because it's those numbers, those firm numbers, that are actually going to help us to determine where the next efforts are going to need to happen. Obviously, going to want to look at new projects on the basis of that. There's a lot of activity within the health service as a whole because of the gender equality duty and the move towards all NHS bodies achieving a single equality scheme as soon as they can. And I think one very important thing, going back to the type of problems I highlighted at the outset, is that we actually need to tackle the issue of how commissioning happens, to make sure that there is choice, to make sure that commissioners understand the needs of trans people and that they are entitled to receive treatment, a choice of treatment in which they actually, their views are taken into account within a reasonable timescale, like everybody else. In effect, to make sure that people who turn to the NHS for help are actually receiving it. Thank you very much.